You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of June, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, our Hong Kong Bureau Chief Aisha Spears joins us to set the day's news agenda with the three stories we need to know about. Aisha, what have you got for us today?
Top of the news is, of course, Edward Snowden being in Hong Kong. We're also going to look at anti-discrimination laws and Hong Kong's chief executive visiting Mayor Bloomberg in New York.
Also on the program, former President Nelson Mandela spends a fourth day in hospital. But when the worst does happen, what would his passing do to South Africa?
And we're given a tour of London's Serpentine Pavilion by its new designer, Su Fujimoto.
One of the things we can see clearly in this Japanese architecture is this ability to almost go into finding ways beyond gravity, no? And have this incredible lightness. And I think that that's something which Su is so strong at.
All that, plus we'll find out if the world is a more peaceful place in 2013, and we'll also get a roundup of the news from Spain.
Also, we'll play some music too. That is all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
As Dominic Reynolds just said, what more could you possibly want
nothing,
in a radio program?
Nothing more.
Nothing. But here is Bill Bingham first with the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News. Riot police have stormed through barricades to clear Istanbul's Taksim Square, prompting new clashes with anti-government protesters. It comes after Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan agreed to meet the protest organisers on Wednesday. Anti-government unrest was sparked almost 2 weeks ago by a heavy police crackdown on a local protest over Gezi Park near Taksim Square. Monocle's Caleb Lauer, who's in Istanbul, has been watching the police action.
They're trying to clear the square of protesters, which has been covered with flags and various types of settlements, tents, shacks, etc. And so they went in with a squad of police and what they call POMAs, which are these water cannon trucks. And they've been confronted by protesters who've been unhappy with that. And there's been Molotov cocktails thrown and. So it's turning into a fairly serious confrontation.
A leading reformist candidate in this week's Iranian presidential election, Mohammad Reza Aref, has dropped out of the race. His website says the head of the reformist movement, Mohammad Khatami, has asked him to withdraw. There have been recent calls for Mr. Aref to quit in favour of moderate candidate Hassan Rouhani. The ex-CIA employee who leaked details of undercover phone and internet surveillance in the United States has disappeared from his hotel in Hong Kong. 29-year-old Edward Snowden left the hotel on Monday. It's believed he's still in Hong Kong. The US National Security Agency was given broad powers after the September the 11th attacks in 2001 and can now take advantage of the huge growth in digital data. A spokesman for the US Office of the Director of National Intelligence said Mr. Snowden's case has been referred to the Department of Justice as a criminal matter. Jessalyn Radak, National Security and Human Rights Director of the Government Accountability Project, which supports whistleblowers, says the government is overreaching itself.
Over time, that awareness of wrongdoing sort of builds up, and you feel compelled to talk about it. And the more you talk about it, the more you're ignored, the more you're told it's not a problem. Until eventually you realize that these things need to be determined by the public, not by somebody who was simply hired by the government.
Apologies, that wasn't Jessalyn Radak, that was Mr. Snowden himself. We'll hear from Ms. Radak later. Ex-president of South Africa Nelson Mandela is spending a fourth day in hospital in Pretoria, where he's being treated for a recurring lung infection. Officials say the 94-year-old anti-apartheid hero remains in a serious but stable condition. His relatives, including his ex-wife Winnie, visited him on Monday. He's been in intensive care since he was admitted to hospital on Saturday for the third time this year. A new report says global warming could place one quarter of New York City and 800,000 people into a flood zone by the 2050s. The study, commissioned by city staff, also says climate change could bring New York's temperatures in line with those of the semi-tropical city of Birmingham, Alabama. Higher sea levels would mean 8% of New York City's coastline could see flooding caused by normal high tides. French air traffic controllers are beginning a three-day strike to protest against EU plans to create a single European airspace. They say the single European sky project will affect public safety and their working conditions. Strikes and walkouts are expected to spread across Europe on Wednesday. Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard has described renewed speculation about her leadership prospects as wasted breath. Ms. Gillard's statement follows media reports at the weekend she'd lost the support of an important power broker to her predecessor Kevin Rudd. Polls last week suggested many Labour MPs will lose their seats under Ms. Gillard in the forthcoming election. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bill Bingham. 5 minutes past eight in the morning here in London. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Yes, you are listening to Midori House. We are live from Studio One and we are in London. The time is 15:06 in Hong Kong, 10:06 in Istanbul, and yes, 8:06 a.m. here in London.
But it is to Hong Kong where we're going to head over to now. We start the show with our daily agenda setter, the three stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. And the agenda today will be set by our very own Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears. Good afternoon to you, Aisha. What's the top story there? I guess everyone's on the lookout for Mr. Edward Snowden. He's kind of gone MIA, hasn't he?
They are. I bet you there are people all around Hong Kong who are trying to spot him so they can tell the South China Morning Post exactly where he is. So yes, top news in Hong Kong is, of course, the fact that Edward Snowden has been here for 3 weeks. In fact, he apparently came here on May 20th and is known to have checked out of his hotel in Kowloon yesterday afternoon, as Bill Bingham reported. So people are on the watch out for him here.
I wonder why particularly Hong Kong. Lots of people have pointed out that the man who is concerned about freedoms around the world has gone to a special administrative region, of course, but has gone to China in order to find himself some security. Why Hong Kong specifically?
Indeed. So he cited that it was because of press freedom and because of people, you know, there's political dissent is rife here. And that is the case, you know, especially compared to across the border in China. People the press is considerably more free and people will complain about something if they don't think it's the right thing to do. A lot of people are thinking that he's actually come here, though, because not that he thinks extradition, if the U.S. call for him to be returned to the States, not that that will be prevented and he will stay here, but more that it will be delayed. It's a longer process here in Hong Kong. It's likely that he could be here for a couple of months before he gets sent to the US if they indeed do ask for him to go.
Indeed, and a lot of people today in the South China Morning Post, a big editorial about saying that this is going to be the next big test between Obama and Xi Jinping's relationship over exactly whether Beijing does indeed allow his extradition to the US or blocks it. What are people there in Hong Kong saying will likely happen?
Indeed. Well, of course, this coming off the back of the weekend powwow that they had in California, it couldn't be better timed in terms of looking how President Obama and how President Xi Jinping are going to relate to each other. People in Hong Kong, I think, would, you know, they're supporters of freedom here, despite the fact they don't have a democracy and despite the fact that they are part of China. I think a lot of people would like to see Hong Kong give Snowden a place to stay. And indeed, that would do a lot for the global perception of freedom in this part of the world. But it looks unlikely that would happen. It doesn't seem that Beijing have not commented. It doesn't seem that they will intervene yet. But the US is still to press charges. So I think this is going to develop a lot more over the next 24 hours.
Yeah, it could be tensions on the way. I mean, from a very simple sort of passport stamp point of view, I guess he's on a 90-day visa. He's used up about 20 of them so far. So he hasn't got that much longer before things need to start happening.
Indeed, and it's a very small town. I mean, Hong Kong is small, and everyone he's on the front page of all the major papers here. So if he's trying to walk around and do anything normal in Hong Kong, you know, get on the MTR, go to 7-Eleven, whatever it is he's trying to do, people will spot him. And the journalists, local journalists, have been camped out all over town in hotels trying to look for him. They doorstopped Glenn Greenwald, the Guardian journalist who has talked to him. So people are definitely looking for him. I doubt he's going to be able to go under the radar for too long here.
I don't think he'll be going into 7-Eleven and getting a giant slushie and walking down the streets of Hong Kong. But that's interesting you mention the journalists staking out different locations in Hong Kong. What's been the reaction there from the foreign press? Has there been an influx of journalists from around the world that have flooded into Hong Kong in a bid to try to find this man?
Well, most of the foreign press have offices established here. It's actually last week they had the Society of Publishers in Asia, and you could see really how big a representation, the awards dinner for the Society of Publishers, how big a representation all of the big global press organizations do have here in Hong Kong. So I think they're probably just deploying their local correspondents. But there are people armed with cameras and video cameras and tape recorders stationed at a number of different hotels, just trying to get the scoop on Edward Snowden. And Glenn Greenwald has been very smart in not giving away too much. He's given a number of interviews, of course, but is not going to say anything about where Snowden is.
Aisha, I want to move on to another topic for us this morning, which is some movement on laws against sexual discrimination.
Indeed. So sexual minorities in Hong Kong aren't particularly protected. It's not illegal at all to be homosexual here, but there isn't a lot of protection for the LGBT community. There are no anti-discrimination laws. And it looks like this could be set. The ball is rolling for this to change. An advisory group has been set up by the government to eliminate discrimination against sexual minorities. And it's being chaired by the Chinese University's first female pro-vice chancellor. She's got together 13 members from across the spectrum. So from academic backgrounds, from business backgrounds, but also from sexual minorities. And it's thought that that really will be a big change from the Sexual Minorities Forum that the government had in the past, but a lot of gay rights activists began to abandon because they saw it just as a kind of delaying, time-wasting tactic.
Yes, many gay rights activists not happy with that Sexual Minorities Forum. Has the reaction to this new group been positive then from gay rights activists?
So far, I mean, it's only just been announced that it's been formed, but I think there's a lot more hope in what this group can do. There'll be regular meetings. They've got members from all sorts of different backgrounds. And I think the broad representation is something that people are looking forward to here.
And presumably the eyes of the international community tend to land on issues like this. Is there a sense that for an international global standing, it's important that Hong Kong is seen at least to be taking action on these sorts of issues?
Indeed. I mean, the gay rights issue in Hong Kong is a sensitive one. It's people can be openly gay, but it's not something which is protected. And that does seem to be a silly situation for a city like Hong Kong to be in, and a global city like Hong Kong to be in. Another thing which has come up alongside this new advisory group is that the Equal Opportunities Commission are proposing a law that will protect service providers from their customers. Surprisingly, quite shockingly, actually, customers had been protected from service providers in terms of sexual harassment. But until now, if you were a waitress, if you were an air hostess, if you were working in any sort of domestic work, you couldn't be protected from any sort of sexual harassment. That could happen to you, and there were no laws to protect you at all. And so last year, there were a couple of cases of a Cathay air stewardess and of a domestic worker complaining. And this is changing tide, it seems, in terms of Hong Kong government protecting people for either their sexuality or their sexual preference.
And Aisha, a third story which has grabbed your attention. Of course, you're now based there in Hong Kong, but you used to be our bureau chief over in New York City. Looks like Mayor Bloomberg perhaps is following you around a bit.
Of course, Mayor Bloomberg is following me around, and not the other way around. Well, maybe CY Leung, the chief executive of Hong Kong, has backtracked from where I've come from. He met with New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg yesterday, only for 40 minutes, and the meeting was postponed from Sunday evening. It was thought because of this whole Edward Snowden case, the mayor's office in New York postponed it. They didn't discuss the case at all. Instead, they just discussed quite briefly again, only in 40 minutes, issues between the two cities. I feel like I could write a letter to both of them saying what's right in this city that New York could learn from, and vice versa that Hong Kong could learn from New York.
Well, that's it. You're basically the third person they needed in that meeting. It might have lasted more than 40 minutes.
I think you should have told them that. I know.
So, okay, give us your letter now, Aisha. Give us a few tips. What could New York learn from HK and vice versa?
I think New York could certainly learn a lot if the people behind transport in New York spent a couple of days at the airport here and on any of the public transport here. Being able to land here, have a wonderful experience getting your bag, getting on the express train straight into Central, onto the MTR, which is clean and efficient and affordable. The buses, the trams, all of it, apart from the taxis, who I think have a charm to them. The public transport here is fabulous. And the other way around, I think that Hong Kong could really learn from New York and from Amanda Burden, the planning commissioner there, of how to use their waterfront and put some green space onto the harbour.
Aisha, I'm sure both men are taking notes as we speak. Aisha Spears, international infrastructure expert and our person in Hong Kong, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Coming up next, we'll ask if the ANC depends on Nelson Mandela and if they should.
What can you do in a Moscow traffic jam? Are rich cities boring cities? How do you create a quake-proof capital? Which city has drag stars as taxi drivers? Who lives in the skyscraper squat? How do you build a city from scratch? And who ditched the garbage truck for a pony and cart? Get the answers to the city's biggest questions and challenges every week on The Urbanist, our show about the cities we live in. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, it premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
With a nod to the past and a wink to the future, Monocle takes a look at the world of perfume and the new generation of expert alchemists.
One of the things that becomes quite an achievement in fragrance is creating that intangible magic when three or four or five disparate elements come together. And in that sense, it's not dissimilar to the visual arts, to painting, or to music.
Artisan Perfume Makers, a film from London, New York, and Buenos Aires on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, South Africans and indeed the rest of the world are holding their breath as Nelson Mandela continues to battle a recurring lung infection dating back to his prison days on Robben Island. Now entering a fourth day since he was admitted to Pretoria Hospital, South Africans are understandably fearful of the inevitable.
With visits from his children and close friends, it seems they are getting ready for a future without him. But what would a South Africa, and more specifically the African National Congress, without its leader look like? Well, joining us now on the line is Mzuo Palase, a political strategist and analyst from South Africa. Mzuo, many thanks for joining us here on Midori House. Nelson Mandela spending a fourth day in hospital. Bring us up to date with the latest situation there.
Well, the latest situation from the presidency is that they're the only ones authorized to speak on this. They say that he is stable but in intensive care. That's the line that is coming from the presidency. But other than that, it speaks to what you're saying right now, that it's becoming almost a reality that South Africa will have to deal without Mandela in the future. And, it's worrying for the ANC, worrying for South Africans as well.
I wonder, you alluded there to the fact that the presidency is the only authorised voice on this topic, but there are plenty of other unauthorised voices out there as well. We've had sort of off-the-cuff remarks from relatives and other people who claim to have knowledge about the situation. How problematic is that sort of media vacuum that's been created?
Well, problematic in the sense that it creates speculation. We never get any official word from anyone else except for the presidency. And of course, we know that when you're dealing with government entities, they tend to be more economical on the truth in some instances. And this is what has happened. And this is not the first time, I would imagine, that the ANC has been caught, almost trying to monopolize the whole dealing of Mandela or news about Mandela. So that poses a challenge for the media, poses a challenge for the South African public. But then again, the ANC has always taken the view that Mandela belongs to the ANC, and to pretend otherwise at this stage would be on our part economical on the truth.
And Mzuo, many people, though, are asking the question, what will happen to the ANC once Mandela does go? The ANC is extremely divided right now within its own party. Many people have criticized Jacob Zuma just recently in this year for using Mandela as a political tool, using those images of him sitting there very frailly with Zuma smiling, quite fanatically next to him. What will happen with the ANC once Mandela is gone?
Well, they'll need to cultivate more leaders of the same caliber as Mandela. That is the biggest ask for them. For a while, the ANC has been leveraging on the point that, you know, really do you have a situation where the party that led sort of a liberation movement now has the icon that, you know, led, or at least the whole liberation movement was galvanized around. So now the party will sort of need to redefine itself. It will need to say that, you know, we had Mandela, but we have plenty more Mandelas, something that has been lacking. As you say right now, the ANC has been characterized by infighting, factionalism, and not actually bringing about the same leaders of and Mandela's stature, and also the leaders that are currently there, you know, they're involved in corruption. There's this perception that within the ranks of the ANC, corruption is rampant. There is sort of no moral guiding compass, which is what Mandela brought. So that's the challenge that the ANC would face moving forward.
Moving forward, the ANC doesn't seem to have any likely candidate or character that would be able to fit any of those qualities that you think is necessary in a leader to lead the ANC.
Well, you know, to their credit, they don't currently, as it stands right now. You know, to Zuma pales in comparison to Mandela, or any, you know, of their top six leaders fail to compare to Mandela as it stands right now. But to their credit, I think they've seen that if they continue to have factionalism, if they continue to have corruption within their own ranks, it won't do their cause to be in power any much good than it has. So they're trying. You know, last year, after the whole Manga Wong, which was their elective conference, where they had like these divisions, the same sort of factionalism, they spoke of, you know, naming and shaming corrupt individuals from their party and government positions, and also bringing about a political school of leadership for the ANC, which means that they also want to sort of impart some of the morals, some of the leadership skills that all these older leaders had, and must probably address this leadership deficit that they face. But whether that addresses their weaknesses in the short to medium term is questionable, but nonetheless, they seem to realize that at least.
I mean, beyond the question of individual candidates, is the ANC struggling with a question of narrative? That there was one narrative of the Liberation Party, which Mandela brought forward, then took power through somebody else. But the question of what the next stage in their sort of story arc is still unanswered. Is there a sort of bigger question about purpose at this point?
Yes, definitely. You know, it's gotten to a stage now. South Africa is almost 20 years into the democracy that everyone fought for. And now the narrative is, you know, it has to be now delivery. It has to be competency. It has to be efficient service delivery on the part of the government. And the ANC as a liberation party, which has used the sort of liberation phraseology, ideologies, and all of that as mileage in this past 20 years, is now struggling, one would say, to govern. So I think the sort of next chapter in this is that they have to prove that they are able to move from that transition of being a liberation party, you know, not characterized by personalization of power and, you know, glorification of individuals, but one to from a liberation movement, but to a party that now is able to deliver, to a party that is more pragmatic and does not rely on its history, but relies on its present, you know, competencies in government.
Mazur Palase, political strategist and analyst, talking to us from South Africa. Thanks very much. Welcome back to Midori House. Now, for 7 years, the Institute for Economics and Peace has compiled the Global Peace Index. It's an insight into the increases and decreases in peace on the world stage. Syria's recent history exposes the cost of a conflict spiralling out of control, a record fall reported in the index's history. Afghanistan is at rock bottom, while Iceland tops the list as the most peaceful.
While combining 22 indicators across 162 countries, ranging from civil unrest to crime, you may be unsurprised to hear that after the last year, the reading of the 7th Peace Index may not be that comforting. Well, to help us run through some of the key findings is Steve Killelea, founder and chairman of the organization that produces the index, the Institute for Economics and Peace. He joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
So the world is not very safe. It's not as safe as it was last year.
Well, what we've found is that peace has decreased slightly in the last 12 months. So that's probably down about 0.5%. So we wouldn't call that a dramatic drop. But if we look over the last 6 years and look at the trend, then it's definitely declining. So all in all, it's 5% less peaceful than what it was 6 years ago. Now, if we look at the trends over the last 12 months, the decrease in peace can really been driven by two key factors. The first is an increase in homicide rates, but that's mainly been in sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America, whereas when we look at the homicide rates in the rest of the world, they've actually stayed constant. And the other one has been a spike in the expenditure of on the military by a number of authoritarian regimes, such as the DRC, Oman, Syria.
You've alluded to some areas there, which I suppose we may already know the answer to this question, but geographically, give us an idea of where peace is and where peace isn't in the world.
Well, there's a couple of things there which are probably contrary to public perception. So South Asia, which everyone would realise is the least peaceful region in the world, and South Asia includes countries like India, Pakistan and Afghanistan. Second least peaceful region in the world is the Middle East, followed by Russia and East Asia. But Africa is the one which is next. So Africa, for a long, long while, would have been the least peaceful region in the world. But over the last decade, there's been dramatic improvements on the continent compared to the rest of the globe. And a lot of that's on the back of improving relationships between states and the rising economic prosperity of the continent.
It is quite surprising that you say that, considering that Africa saw that dramatic increase in the number of homicides. How does the two relate?
Well, there's 22 indicators within the GPI, homicide being one indicator. So what we do is we measure the internal peacefulness of nations, the external peacefulness of nations, and bring it together as a composite index. But if we look on the back of the increase in homicides, a lot of that's getting fueled by urbanisation. So as the economies take off, people move to the cities, then what that then does is tend to increase crime within the slums. But it's not all bad news. One of the most remarkable trends is when you look into, let's say, the UK, the US, Australia, and a number of other European nations, we're finding the long-term crime rates and trends for crime are dropping. That'd be epitomised by, let's say, in the UK, you've had a halving of the number of homicides over the last decade. The reduction in the US has even been stronger. So as we start to look at the reasons which are underlying this, it's possible to develop programs which we can take into the Cities of the World project to try and help stabilise them in the future.
Well, I suppose that is the big sort of one of the big usefulnesses of all of the kind of research that you've developed. You've brought all of this information together, and I suppose it points out the other connected sort of factors to peace. Presumably economics is one, population is another, and presumably economic growth, as you say, can lead to urban crime. But on the other end of the scale, a lack of economic growth can lead to crime of a different sort, presumably.
Yes, well, there's lots of touch points there. I'll just try and hit a couple. So what we looked at was the relationship between economic growth and peace. And so if we look at the trend line over the last 6 years, you take the sovereign debt countries like Spain, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, we find that their peace has decreased at a stronger rate than the global average. So to double-check that economic relationship, we then took 2012, went to the World Bank, and looked at the countries which had actually had negative GDP growth. What we found, the same thing. The trend line with them was the trend line with them. So their decrease in peace was stronger than the global average as well. Now, there are very, very strong relationships which we can see with business, like per capita income correlates strongly with peace. You'll also find things like the ease of doing business, a business competitiveness index from the World Bank or the World Economic Forum. They all correlate very, very strongly with peace as well.
And indeed, it is the 2013 Global Peace Index. Steve Kilele, founder and chairman of the Institute for Economics and Peace. Many thanks indeed for coming on the show. Enjoyed that.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Now, in the next half hour of today's programme, we're going to head to Barcelona. For the news from Spain with our man there, Liam Aldous, we will review the British front pages with our news editor, Tom Edwards, and we'll meet the Serpentine Pavilion's new designer, Su Fujimoto.
One of the things we can see clearly in this Japanese architecture is this ability to almost go into finding ways beyond gravity, no? And have this incredible lightness. And I think that that's something which Su is so strong at.
Also defying gravity is Bill Bingham. He's here with the news headlines.
Riot police using tear gas have stormed through barricades to clear Istanbul's Taksim Square, prompting new clashes with anti-government protesters. It comes after Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan agreed to meet the protest organisers on Wednesday. A leading reformist candidate in this week's Iranian presidential election, Mohammad Reza Aref, has dropped out of the race. His website says the head of the reformist movement, Mohammad Khatami, has asked him to withdraw. The ex-CIA employee who leaked details of undercover phone and internet surveillance in the United States has disappeared from his hotel in Hong Kong. 29-year-old Edward Snowden left the hotel on Monday. It's believed he's still in Hong Kong. Ex-president of South Africa Nelson Mandela is spending a fourth day in hospital in Pretoria, where he's being treated for a recurring lung infection. Officials say the 94-year-old anti-apartheid hero remains in a serious but stable condition. His relatives, including his ex-wife Winnie, visited him on Monday. A new report says global warming could place one quarter of New York City and 800,000 people into a flood zone by the 2050s. The study, commissioned by city staff, also says climate change could bring New York's temperatures in line with those of the semi-tropical city of Birmingham, Alabama. French air traffic controllers are beginning a three-day strike to protest against EU plans to create a single European airspace. They say the Single European Sky project will affect public safety and their working conditions. Strikes and walkouts are expected to spread across Europe on Wednesday. Those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn.
Architecture doesn't have to be permanent, and sometimes the freshness and immediacy of a temporary creation has a unique appeal all of its own. And every year, London's Serpentine Gallery invites an international architect to complete a structure that shows the very best of his or her talent and also brings new world architecture to the United Kingdom.
Since the annual project's inception in 2000, the Serpentine Pavilion has become a byword for the best of contemporary art and architecture. And for 4 months during the summer, the pavilion becomes one of London's most exciting cultural nerve centres. Well, for this week's Section D, we sent Monocle's David Pleasant to that nerve centre to meet the architect of this year's pavilion, Su Fujimoto, and some of the other people behind its construction.
My name is Julia Picken-Jones. I'm director of the Serpentine Gallery, and we are standing in Su Fujimoto's pavilion, the 13th in our annual series, in Kensington Gardens, London.
Could you tell us a little bit about the process of choosing the architect every year? It must be a very difficult task, and this pavilion is certainly a wonderful contrast to last year's pavilion. Tell us a bit about that process.
Well, it's a curatorial decision, and in that sense is very different to the normal process whereby architects are selected. But we are an art gallery, not an architectural institution. So what we've done is take the criteria that we use for deciding artists who are going to be in our programme to deciding the architect who's going to design the pavilion. So Hans Ulrich and I, together with Jochen Volz, as head of programmes, discuss this at length in one of our programming meetings and make the final decision. So there is no competition, and that's really what differentiates this project, well, one of the many reasons that differentiates this project from other architectural schemes. And then we work with the architect in just the same way as we do with an artist to realise their vision. The whole process takes 6 months from conception to completion. And, you know, it's a very, very focused, highly energised, extraordinarily engaging, high-risk venture that is really an unbelievable pleasure.
My name is Hans-Ulrich Oris. I'm co-director of the Serpentine Gallery.
And if we can talk specifically about So's work, you describe very eloquently something of his work and his inspirations. Tell us a bit about this wonderful space. We're in the sunshine. We're kind of in amongst the nature and the park around us. Tell us a bit more about that.
So Fujimoto has always actually combined geometry with nature from the very beginning of his work. We met him 6-7 years ago and in Tokyo, and ever since, you know, have maintained a dialogue with him. He made a wonderful presentation here in the Frank Gehry Pavilion, where he presented one of his early work, you know, the wood house, whilst actually more and more, you know, he started to work with these geometric shapes, as we can see it here, in sort of sense of repetition and difference. And as many other Japanese architects, I mean, there's this amazing Japanese architecture context, generation after generation. There's Tange, there are the metabolists, Toyo Ito, Seijima, you know, and now Su Fujimoto, they've all nurtured each other. And one of the things we can see clearly in this Japanese architecture is this ability to almost go into finding ways beyond gravity, no? And have this incredible lightness. And I think that that's something which Su is so strong at. The other thing is certainly this way of bringing nature in, and at the same time, we are inside and we are outside because the pavilion is actually open. Nevertheless, there are these zones which are protected against the rain, you know, through these wonderful transparent objects. So it's actually both inside and outside.
My name is David Glover. I'm the chief executive for AECOM Building Engineering, and this year I've led the team for the design and of the Serpentine Pavilion.
With this pavilion in particular, you really feel a kind of engineered aspect of it. Tell us a bit about what went into pulling this together. It's quite complex, isn't it?
It is a very complex pavilion. You know, it's got over 10,500 nodes. It's got 27,000 members. And one of the things is the speed of the Serpentine Pavilion, which, to be quite honest, is something I've always enjoyed, because you go from that very early concept in January to opening on the 4th of June is always going to be a challenge. And I think the thing here is that this is such a complex building that we ended up having to work totally in 3D with this. And we also had 4,000 miles between So's team in Tokyo and ours in London, and also the fabricators up in Yorkshire, that fundamentally we had to work 24/7. We used to do a 12-hour shift, they would do a 12-hour shift, and we would play with the structure and the form so that we could make sure we had the best seating, the structure could work and stand up, and at the same time end up working with the fabricators to make sure that we could actually manufacture every one of those nodes and members in the 6 weeks fabrication time they had. But equally, from So's point of view and ours, it was really important that the design intent was retained. And, you know, I think you can see from the pavilion, it really does feel like that's been the case. So we worked immensely hard with So to make sure that we made sure that the joints looked monolithic. We could build it in the factory because of the wonderful English weather early in the year wasn't going to allow you to build it on site. And, you know, Ted only has this site for 6 weeks before he has to lay all the foundations and erect it. So we had 17 truckloads of, I think, 54 modules come down the road. They were craned in place, fixed in place, and made to look totally in this monolithic manner.
If I could just ask, going back to that kind of time period, so it's a kind of compressed project. So it's got the ambitions and the kind of style of a big project, a kind of big kind of public enterprise, big public project, but the time scale is kind of compressed. Do you think that it's the same in terms of the engineering? It's got the kind of largesse and the feeling of a big engineering project, but you've got to kind of reduce everything down. Is that how it feels like working on these pavilions?
Oh yes, certainly, and I think that's why the teams enjoy it, because very often those big projects can be, you know, I've worked on Leadenhall Tower here, you know, it's 12 years from the first day till it's being built now, whereas this, you have all of those same pressures. But I think the need to make decisions And that's where a true designer comes out. And that's the thing I was saying about So. You know, he was a true designer. He wasn't railroaded. He understood the issues and then adapted the design without losing that intent. And I think that's the that is one of the beauties of something like the Serpentine Pavilion.
I'm Su Fujimoto from Tokyo. And now I'm just in front of the Serpentine Summer Pavilion 2013, the this year pavilion. And I designed this pavilion.
It's been described as a cloud, many things. How would you describe it? What was your idea behind this pavilion?
We could say this is an artificial cloud or artificial forest or something like that. Because my intention is to create something between nature and architecture. So these pavilions are made by grids, by thin steel structures. It's made by really, really many grids. And this grid structure is a really artificial, transparent, sharp edge. But at the same time, the whole shapes and the whole experience is more organic and soft, like a cloud. So try to create nice integrations, nice mixtures of the nature things and the artificial things together.
And you've spoken somewhat about that, your feelings of architecture as part of nature, or some forms of nature being architecture as well. So is that a big part of your design philosophy and something that you've considered throughout your work?
Well, yes, exactly. Yeah, I'm interested in, of course, the nature, and it is because it is really fundamental. And how to integrate or how to mix nature and architecture things is one of the really, really fundamental topic and question, I think. So I try to understand such a basic thing. So I try to find something new from really fundamental things. So that has been throughout my career, that has been my great interest.
That was Su Fujimoto, the architect behind this year's Serpentine Pavilion in London. He was speaking to Monocle's David Pleasant for this week's edition of Section D, and there is more of it tonight at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with a roundup of the press from Spain with our man Liam Aldis.
For centuries, Sulaymaniyah has been a magnet for artists. On assignment in northern Iraq, Monocle's foreign editor Steve Blumfield met with would-be hip-hop artists, painters and poets to discover the city's new creative wave.
Kurdistan exists, and yet it doesn't. It's a country, and yet it isn't. It has a soul, though, and a culture, and that's a start. And if that soul, that culture, is to be found anywhere, it is found here in Sulaymaniyah, a city of more than a million in the northeast of Iraq.
The Soul of Sulaymaniyah, a photographic essay on Monocle.com.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time is 9:43 in Barcelona, 8:43 a.m. here in London.
But it is time indeed to head to Spain for a look at the headlines with our man there, Liam Aldis. Welcome to the show. Liam, how are you?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Excellent. Let's begin with an award that's just been handed out, the European Citizen 2013 Prize.
Yes, it was actually awarded last week, and it was given to two Spanish winners, one of which was the Mortgage Victims Association, which have been making headlines lately with their escraches, which are kind of protests at the doors of politicians who are basically opposing or making it difficult to achieve any reform in the draconian mortgage law or the eviction law that Spain has. But this has outraged the ruling party.
Explain how complicated and draconian this law is. Explain why people are so upset about it.
Well, basically, if you explain the draconian aspects of this law to anyone outside of Spain, they're outraged. And basically, in a nutshell, it means that Spanish people, once they're evicted from their houses, they still have to keep paying off their home loans. So it's not like this in any other European country except Spain. And it's causing a lot of problems, especially for the people who are evicted.
And some very strong words coming within Rajoy's own cabinet. You know, he's linked this group to terrorists and Nazis.
Yeah, well, they're continuing their campaign to basically delegitimize the group. So they've referred to their techniques as worse than the Nazis, which they're referring to the protests themselves. The the protests have actually caused a lot of the PP politicians to come out and complain about and play the victim as well, whereas the protest group have come out and said the victims are actually the ones being evicted. But after winning this prize, they likened it to the group to terrorists as well, saying that the next thing the European Parliament is going to do is award a prize to an ETA terrorist. So they're just continuing their campaign to delegitimise the group.
So clearly, yeah, a battle over the sort of the status of this group in the minds of the Spanish people. Do the Spanish people care much about this particular award? Does it have a high profile?
It does have a very high profile, particularly because of their protest techniques, which is obviously the point of the protest. But a recent poll showed that about 80% of Spaniards approve of the group and their techniques. So they definitely have the backing of the population, but it's just the ruling party is a step behind, or a big step behind, what the people want. So they seem to be protecting the interests of the banks, and they're not really showing much sign of moving in this area.
And another story, Liam, which has grabbed your attention, ongoing tensions between Catalonia and Madrid about to get a whole lot worse, it seems.
It's difficult to imagine them getting worse, but Artur Mas, who is the regional premier of Catalonia, announced just last week that he's going to hold a summit in December, which is just on the eve of the 300-year anniversary of Spain's conquest of Catalonia, which actually came about through the marriage of various kind of dynasties. But let's not get into the historical nuances. Basically, he's called this summit. It's going to be titled Spain Against Catalonia, 300 Years of Repression. So it seems that the conclusions are already predetermined on this summit, but it was actually announced that it's going to cost about €1 million, and this isn't a really good look when Catalonia is basically bankrupt.
And presumably is going to be hugely divisive. Why now? We've got the 300-year anniversary. Is pressure rising on this issue as we approach this sort of landmark year?
Well, it kind of in the international media, it kind of fizzled out, this issue, after the Catalonian elections last year. But there has still been a lot of internal chatter about the calling of a plebiscite or a referendum on Catalonian independence, even though the Spanish constitution doesn't allow it. So this is just seen as another attempt by Mas to keep the issue in the air and to keep the momentum going towards a plebiscite, which they are still planning on holding next year. Which is going to be timed as well for the 300-year anniversary. So it's all a lot of there's a lot of political significance in there. But Mas is continuing his campaign. He's even going on another trip to overseas trip to Brazil to kind of ramp up the international pressure. His last international trip didn't really go that well. He went to Russia and was meant to meet with some high level politicians, but they all gave him the cold shoulder. So he was left in his hotel room all alone.
And Liam, just building on Dominic's question, there is this issue of importance on the streets of Barcelona. Will you find the average resident of Barcelona talking about this as a serious issue for them to really own?
There are two minds about it. A lot of Catalonians still feel this sense of injustice. The title of this conference kind of really taps into this sense that Catalans feel that Spain and Madrid is oppressing them in a lot of ways. They feel that if they're not, they're taking a lot of their taxes, and their taxes are going down to the south of Spain. If it's not that, it's the fact that Madrid steps in and prevents big infrastructure projects because they don't want Catalonia to have too much power. I heard someone at an architectural conference the other day complain that Catalonia or the Madrid prevented Catalonia from having a railway to the north of a freightway railway to the north of Europe because they didn't want Catalonia to have too much economic power. So there are a lot of people think there's this conspiracy against Catalonia, which is obviously why this conference has been, or this summer has been, titled in this way.
Liam, I want to talk to you about, just before you go, about one small town that's on a quest to clean up its streets, but in a pretty extraordinary way. I'm not sure I can quite believe this story. This is about ways to encourage careless residents to clean up after their dogs. How are they doing it?
It is actually unbelievable, and I don't know what to think about it. In one way, I'll explain it, basically. This small town called Brunete on the outside of Madrid, the Madrid region, has basically called in an advertising agency to stop people, or to devise a way to stop people from leaving the excrement of their dogs around. And the way they've done this is they've employed a team of volunteers to go around spying on the residents, to see the people who are not picking up after their dogs, go up and initiate conversation with them, find out the dog's name, and then use the municipal register to actually find out their address. obviously when they pick up, when they talk to these people, they pick up the excrement and they send it to their house in a box. So it's worrying on two levels. One is that the town is obviously sending dog poop to their residents, and the other one is they're hiring a team of Stasi-like spies to spy on the residents and ascertain their addresses to send them this poop.
It's quite extraordinary. I mean, it's the sort of thing that people used to claim that teenagers would do in my local town. I can't believe that there's actually an advertising agency that's being paid to do this.
This happened to me yesterday. Like, I was I was running through Battersea Park here in London, and there was a dog walker there, and the dog did his business, but he didn't pick it up.
The dog didn't. He hasn't got opposable thumbs. Don't blame him.
The owner didn't pick it up, so I wasn't sure. Was I supposed to say something to him?
Yeah, you definitely should have done. Liam, what do you think?
Well, I don't know what you guys should do, but I'm kind of worried about this. It's got a worrying sign, but it actually has worked. There's a 70% less excrement on the streets of this small town. But I'm still wondering where these people come from. Are they people employed outside of the town that have come to spy on the residents, or are they hiring residents to spy on other residents? It's all quite worrying.
So many questions. We'll have to come back to you on the question of the dog poop in the box. Liam Aldous, many thanks indeed for coming on the show today.
Well, in a moment, we'll be reviewing this morning's front pages with our very special Tom Edwards, our Monocle 24 news editor. But to get us there, the perfectly named song for Tom. This is Kylie with Aphrodite. Dominic, I liked your head bopping there.
I always like to head bop with Kylie. It's a rule.
That's good. That's good. That was, of course, Kylie Minogue there with Aphrodite. Now, our very own special Aphrodite is now in studio. We're joined by our news editor, Tom Edwards, fresh off the plane from the Pacific Northwest over in North America. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Hi, Phil. Really great to be back and to hear your unique comedy stylings firsthand.
Just shaking his head at the radio flirtation of Phil Hahn.
I know. It's a terrifying thing. I'm sure our listeners are well familiar with.
Okay. But you are not here just to flirt with Phil. You are here to run through the newspapers. So what have we got?
That's right. Well, I thought we'd start with The Guardian. I mean, they've been covering this story about this big leak of sensitive American security information. We've been covering the story on Monocle 24, I know, while I've not been here. But they have an interesting piece, a comment piece by Daniel Ellsberg, who is a US military analyst in the 70s, and he leaked the Pentagon Papers. And if you remember, obviously all about how the US public could be misled about events to do with the Vietnam War. And in his opinion, as The Guardian highlights on its front page, there's not been in all American history a more important leak of documents than this release of NSA material by Edward Snowden. And the comment piece asked the question, have we been saved from the United Stasi of America?
Nice.
Which is clever. But he says it's a more significant act of bravery than his own over the Pentagon Papers.
Well, I mean, he's the one person who can make that sort of claim, can't he? He can measure bravery in revealing information. And there hasn't been that much focus on the man himself, it seems, which is what he wants, by the sounds of things. He's trying not to become a character by himself, trying not to become an Assange-like figure.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Obviously, he's now fled to Hong Kong. There is this fascination with whistleblowers on this scale, where they go, how they seem to be sort of prosecuted in one way or another. But Ellsberg makes the point that I think he feels that the whistleblowing by Edward Snowden was about more than, this one incident, about more than the character. He says, I'm not suggesting the US is a police state, but the electronic and legislative infrastructure we have is similar to one.
Well, it has the capacity to become one, doesn't it?
Right.
Which I suppose is the point of his warning.
Especially in that electronic realm. And I think that's why this is interesting and why it will, run and run, as indeed Edward Snowden might have to.
Very good, very good.
What else have you got for us?
Well, I thought there's an interesting little piece in Financial Times about a potential piece of kind of quantitative easing that may happen inadvertently here in the UK. George Osborne is keeping an eye on Vodafone, who may be selling their significant stake in Verizon Wireless, a big US mobile communications provider. Vodafone owns about 45% of that operation, and apparently Verizon might want to buy it back, and it would cost them, well, it would cost over $100 billion.
And what's behind this, the sudden sale, perhaps?
Well, presumably just that they want to control it on their own. But what it would mean, of course, is that it could mean potentially a huge windfall for Vodafone shareholders, most of whom are based in this country. So it could be a real fillip to George Osborne. So he's eyeing it greedily.
Is he? He adds it totally impartially. He's greedily eyeing it.
Yeah, that's how you eye things. It's like a cake.
Well, you're enthusiastically ruffling through the papers. What's next?
Well, I thought there was a fun sketch in The Independent today from Donald McIntyre. Against the backdrop of cranes, the PM scaled new heights.
Oh, that's
clever.
Good
rhetorical trickery. And there's a picture of, I think, David Cameron looks a bit nervous there. He was up on this
very nervous indeed.
I like his jacket, though.
Building site. He's wearing high vis. He's got a hard hat. He's on a crane.
It's amazing how quickly, in a costume, he looks like an old lady.
He has an old lady-ish quality.
Yeah.
But Don McIntyre's lampooning some of his stylistic tweaks. Like, he says one of his favourite rhetorical devices is to say, now, some people say, and then list some counter-arguments to his own, and no one says.
Yes.
That's Donald McIntyre's point. So he says, some people say, stop the world, I want to get off, suggesting they're little Englanders. Others say, open your borders, national sovereignty's obsolete, suggesting they're crazed Europhiles. Or, let's have an ever bigger state and ever bigger spending, suggesting that they're just Labour, and that no one actually does that at all. He says he learned it from Tony Blair.
Interesting.
I think Tony Blair learnt the some people say from Fox News, didn't he?
Well, I think that's where, ultimately, all of these evils come back to
you. Tell me just one more story, if you want to
Well, very briefly, this is a fun story in The Telegraph. My alma mater, Cambridge University, famously in the 50s, some students put an Austin 7 on the roof, and no one really knew how they did it. There it is, there's a little bit black and white picture, and some soldiers have been showing how they may have done it, but they were only allowed to lift it 20 feet,
crazy,
not 70
kids.
Feet, because it's too
kids.
Dangerous.
Yeah, good old days. Safety, eh?
Tom Edwards, thanks very much. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Alad John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and James Bullock. Our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Up next, after the news, is the latest episode of The Entrepreneurs, presented by the very lovely Sophie Grove.
And I will be back with Cordelia Lynch with Bedore House tomorrow at the same time. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. I'll miss you.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.